Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with friend of the show, Chaz, of The Story Told, The Fall of Giara, Exalted Development, as well as a prolific author on The Storyteller Vault, and we are going to talk about surrealism and, more importantly, Invisible Sun. But first off, Chaz, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty great. I would be hard-pressed to call myself a prolific author of The Storyteller's Vault, but I have prolific aspirations there.
There we go. I was going to say prolific in the making, on the way to. We are going to talk about surrealism. It is an element that pops up a lot in Mage of the Ascension, and in my opinion, surrealism heart. It creates a fundamental tension in a game between wanting to have rules and wanting to depart from them. And unless everyone holds hands real tightly or agrees about what they're doing ahead of time, that can get a little bit messy.
So before we really get into that, let's establish some ground rules. What is surrealism?
Surrealism kind of breaks into at least two pieces. One is the artistic movement. The other is the traits behind it. The artistic movement kind of consisted of two early schools that grew out of the Dadaist and anti-art movement. The Dadaists, generally centered in Switzerland, repeatedly asked the question, what is art? And it was a response to World War I and the active rejection of standards. They did their art through strange cut-ups, collages, ready-made, which is where you just find an object and declare it to be art. Marcel Duchamp's water fountain, which is just a urinal that was turned upside down, is probably the best example of this. And a lot of mixed media stuff. The Philadelphia Art Museum has a wonderful Duchamp exhibit, so I am spoiled for this. And I think one of the things that a lot of people miss about a lot of the Dadaists is they knew exactly what they were doing in a lot of cases. They were very much attempting to be provocative and not necessarily in an academic sense, which I kind of appreciated. The other wing of the Surrealist movement were known as the Automaticists, who wanted to suppress reason and allow the subconscious to act, and they thought that that would create art. This was led by the French poet André Breton, who eventually lost control of the movement. I think Breton was a bit of a jerk, mostly because he rejected a lot of people from the Surrealist movement, and all the people he rejected, I really liked. Like, he took a pot shot at René Magritte's wife, and the fact that René Magritte, who in my head is a stone-cold, the professional-level assassin, did not throw him out of a moving vehicle, shows how cool René Magritte is. The Sur and Surreality is an attempt to blend the real with the quality of dreams, creating something that is neither, and the Sur being, I think, below the real.
That sounds right to me.
There is the feeling that it should depict things that shouldn't work necessarily as it should, that follows dream logic. It often involves surprise, juxtaposition, and randomness. One of the things I liked about a lot of the Surrealists is they were very skilled and accomplished painters. They were going to render a dreamlike setting as accurately as they could. For instance, the Dali painting Dream Caused by the Flight of a Bee Around a Pomegranate a Second Before Awakening is, to me, a very technically capable piece, as is a lot of the work by Kay Sage, where you have the depiction of these seemingly apocalyptic and cyclopean landscapes, which are gorgeously rendered. It is a accurate landscape painting of that landscape. Now, Joan Miró and Max Ernst departed from that a little bit, but the branches of the genre that I like were pretty big. Ultimately, Breton claimed that it was fundamentally a political movement, in that the idea was to tear down the establishment. That's not really what we're focusing on. If your game wants to, that perfectly makes sense. They wanted to free people from a false sense of reality, that shocking art could question norms and customs.
Boy, that seems like it has some alignment with Mish.
Yeah. There was a kind of scientific bend where people were trying to find ways to free the power of the unconscious and the subconscious. Chaz, is there anything that resonates for you with surrealist art?
So for me, when I think about surrealism, my focus is on the dreamlike quality, especially if we're talking about games or art in games. It's introducing the strange, but not in a strange context. So like, what do I mean by that? When you look at something on the face of it, you're like, yeah, that's strange. But in the context of what you're looking at, it is supposed to be there. Like, it's just the way things are.
When you have one of those weird dreams and your third grade teacher and you are going spelunking in the moment, it seems perfectly rational that your third grade teacher is the person you're going spelunking with and your rope is entirely made out of toothpaste or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly.
I will have a bunch of show notes for it, but when I think of surrealism, it generally is that focus on the Central European, pardon me, what's the term for like France through Austria? Just continental Europe?
Yeah, it is. Because once you get to Austria, you're really in Central Europe,
yeah.
Even though a lot of people say it's Western Europe, but it's not.
Yeah. But when I think of the luminaries of the movement, I go to Salvador Dali, who eventually had a fallout with Breton. Good job, Dali. Dorothea Tanning and Max Ernst, Kaysage and Yves Tanguay. Alberto Giacometti, to a limited extent. Lenora Carrington. This was an art movement that had a fair amount of non-male representation to it, which I like. You have to do a little bit more digging. They don't get as many gallery shows to it. If you're looking for something similar to it, Hector Hoppolite and Giorgio de Chirico come to mind. De Chirico never really embraced surrealism as a title. He referred to what he did as metaphysical art, which I don't know if there's anything more mage than that, but is certainly an inspiration to me. If you, like me, were like, surrealism so white, Afro-surrealism is a fascinating genre, and I'll include some links in the show notes. In film, Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley is sometimes considered parts of the genre. When it comes to black representation of art in media and surrealist elements, we can't talk about the topic without mentioning how many art references are in Beyoncé videos, and every time I see one, I just kind of love it. The symbolic surreal portraiture in the black art community has existed at this point for decades. I liked that André Breton went around, quote-unquote, discovering surrealists, and my favorite quote about this is by Frida Kahlo, who said, "I never knew I was a surrealist until André Breton came to Mexico and told me I was one." Like, yup. There are likely other surrealist movements. I just may not be familiar with them. So if you have any, by all means, drop it in our Discord. Now to the tricky part. Where do we surrealism in Mage?
So now we get to the hard part where we say, where is surrealism in Mage? Terry, are there parts of the Mage world that scream surrealism to you?
Yes.
Out of very small mouths set in the wall?
There's literally the Maya, or the Dreamland, which obeys dream logic. And this is a part that we never really get information from. A character may describe how they choose to cook the alphabet if they are to gain a lost memory from a dream lord. Chaz, you're familiar with Changeling. Do we ever get the idea that Arcadia is surreal, or is it just kind of legendary?
Oh yeah, no, very much surreal. And well, not so much for Arcadia itself, but for the dreaming, which is the part that Changelings can get to, the other world that Changelings travel to. Arcadia is hidden somewhere deep within the dreaming, and we never get any real concrete information about it. But within the dreaming, things are archetypical, things are based on imagination and dreams, and so is a very fertile ground for surreal elements as you're traveling.
Another common one are paradox realms that will have strange properties, mindscapes which are reachable via the dream background or the domain background, or when aiding someone else in dealing with a quiet. There are also places in the high umbra which are going to be explicitly more surreal. Say, for instance, the epiphany of equivalence, where everything is done normally, but the mechanism of action changes. Your group starts in a small town looking for information. When they read a book, they receive a letter with what they need, as opposed to finding it in the text. As the building falls apart, they run out, but instead they are taking pogo sticks. Later, during a fight, a character fires a gun, launching a fusillade of sharpened bananas. All of these are regular roles. They are reduced to very banal attribute plus ability. It is just the expression of them in game is fantastical. And the glory of this is, since you have the mechanic to point back to, you can have the player describe it and nothing bad happens. Like, at the end of the day, when someone gets hit in combat for 3 health levels of damage, who cares about the mechanism more or less? And that is kind of a simple way to introduce surrealism. And that is one where, at least for me, I would signpost the heck out of it and say, hey, this is literally what we're doing. I don't like to surprise players with stuff like that otherwise in a lot of cases, or at least I think I don't.
Are there any beings in Mage that you would consider surreal?
I think this is mildly contentious, but I think the answer is yes. There are a number of dreamlike entities that can be introduced, like Gafflings and Jaglings. The middle Umbra is very emotion and feeling driven, and I would not be surprised to have entities that operate off of the sense of what is right. You can have nightmare entities or a type of paradox spirit or hobgoblins that kind of run around that obey this dreamlike logic, that are able to injure you with giant hat pins that force you to vomit up painful childhood memories, and that is how damage is done to you, or something like that. Paradox spirits often have the ability to just kind of mutate reality. It's one of those wonderful cases of paradox spirits seemingly causing paradox. One of the ones that is tricky to me is the question of the marauders, and are they surreal? To me, no. Often a marauder believes that they are being rational, whereas in surrealism, the action is generally more deliberate. They will appear to be surreal, but I would not say that they and of themselves necessarily are. A given marauder could be, and we will discuss manifestations of paradigm that have to do with surrealism, but those are kind of the obvious ones that do it to me. Do you recall anything in Changeling that you're like, oh, that's some surrealism, or anything from your time in World of Darkness?
I don't know about my time from World in Darkness, but in Chronicles of Darkness, which shares a lot in common with the Middle Umbra in the way that the Shadow is populated with conceptual spirits, there was a great session where our werewolf spiritualist was traveling in to the Shadow to prove herself, and made a pact with a trash spirit, which multiplied prolifically, and then had to go back and make an encouraging garbage truck spirit to come and like devour all of the trash spirits. And so you had this case where like there were trash spirits that are like living manifestations of trash running around, and a predatory garbage truck like chasing them down and eating them. That seems a little surreal to me. A moment ago you mentioned paradigm manifesting in surreal ways that implies surreal magic. So how does magic manifest in surreal ways in Mage?
Often with paradox is how I will put it. But a pre-question to me when we talk about manifestations of magic is, who is seeing it? For instance, a quiet can be highly surreal and is often only visible to the character and those in their mindscape, whereas a paradox backlash may or may not be visible. When the agents of the Death of Tuesday arrive to deliver the sublime edict that indicates that Kiwis can no longer be housed in your home, is that something that you see, or is that something that everyone sees? I have found it effective to write up the weirdness that if a single character is the only one seeing something, to hand them the description and then they kind of read it to the table. And at least for me, it is much more menacing when the character/player says, "This is what I saw," and everyone's like, "That shit's fucked up." Or at least that's my experience.
So even if experienced by an individual character, it is still surreal to all of the players around the table who are participating in the narrative.
Yes, the players will hear it and they will understand kind of the nature of the interaction, and their characters will hear it. I feel comfortable saying that Mage is a game where if everyone shared their experience of magic in the world, every mage would think every other mage is more or less crazy. So the question is, part of the satire of the game is everyone recognizes that everyone else is experiencing it, but for whatever reason, hearing that out loud kind of brings it into sharp focus. So the character that is willing to admit this is being more truthful, but is at the same time considered maybe ostracized by some people for saying the quiet part out loud, as it
were. Got it.
Some of the simplest ways to add little whiffs of this are going to be with resonance. For instance, the master who slams their fists on a table and dust motes form into tigers with clocks for eyes and a hide of thorns that glow the color of burning tears. That is something that you can just add. It's not going to be disruptive in most cases, but it kind of shows you the sheer amount of magic that could be present.
Paradox also embodies the impossible in ways the surreal does. This can come in a couple of ways. For example, with flaws, a paradox backlash causes all the scars on a mage's body to turn into zippers and slowly unzip, dumping out flowers covered in the faces of children yet unborn. The character must spend an action each turn re-zipping the zippers or take a point of unsoakable lethal damage as their essence comes out.
In terms of quiet, a character is drawn into a dreamlike realm where they may only escape by embracing the dream logic that a character must scream the digits of pi to unlock the tumblers of the 8 great locks of reason. The character thenceforth mutters random number of strings when using doorknobs to avoid being pulled back into that quiet.
Emanations, which are Terry's terms for non-active embodiments of quiet, where the character could be pursued by agents of the conspiracy of anti-time, who have bird cages for abdomens that contain the descent of folly that pursues those who wish to unweave destiny. Boy, that's some Invisible Sun bullshit.
It also has to do with birds.
Each bird is a different type of woodpecker. The descent is identifiable by their bowler hats made of molten wood. The caged birds cry out in Gregorian chant.
So I have added the idea that hobgoblins are active manifestations of quiet, where emanations. So a hobgoblin might be a small creature or an invisible person or an active voice that kind of follows you around, where an emanation is a passive thing that kind of serves as a symbol and reminder that you are in quiet.
Cool.
All of these examples are just things I kind of came up with. So that kind of, this is what happens when Terry's left alone with his thoughts.
How does the surreal play to paradigms and practice?
So the hard part here to me is fitting it into the regular framework of paradigm that is provided in M20. We have paradigms like the world is ultimately chaos, but I don't think it is quite what surrealism gets at. To me, surrealism is a different kind of logic, or that there is more below the surface than one meets. And to me, I show this in the form of magics that surrealist practitioners can do. For instance, a common one is psionics. Your character believes that they can tap into great mental powers, but only by suppressing their conscious mind. This was a big thing that the automaticists were big on. This could involve something like automatic writing, where you just kind of move your hand. A modern version of this would be automatic typing, where you just kind of type and you see what comes out the other end. Lucid dreaming, where a character attempts to dream and then control it by realizing that they are dreaming. Being woken suddenly and recording their first impressions. Piet Mondrian, one, a lot of his weird compositions where it's just color splotches were an attempt to emulate that first moment of consciousness where the eye opens and the world is not yet in focus. And a character using art of that type to harness what they believe is the hidden power of the mind or the consciousness or ability to connect to something greater, I think can allow for what we would traditionally refer to as psionics, great mental powers that they think are embodied in all humans, but certain techniques are required to access it.
Another example for surreal magic could be platonic pulling, a character believing that they can pull things into the world from ideas and dreams, which come from a literal place that it's distant. Dreams, in this case, are just another form of idea. They can manifest strange but useful objects by entering an altered state and breaking the barrier between the dream and reality.
Neoplatonism is a thing that kind of comes up in Mage a bit, and normally we talk about the perfected or rational ultimate form of an object, but here, instead of pulling the perfect cube out of the Platonic realm, you are pulling a idea out of your dreamscape. Another one I thought of was the idea of semantic breakdown. A character believes that nouns are maintained by the thoughts we have about them. A relationship exists because of the conventions of dating or a friendship, and that a character can perform a rigorous teardown of the presumed conventions about that thing to destroy it. This is kind of a combination of Breton's idea that through surrealism we can destroy the patriarchy, and also kind of the ideas of Ludwig Wittgenstein that at base it is impossible to define a thing except as a combination of interconnected terms and only with others that can verify our sense information. Beetle in a box experiment is a good one, where a bunch of people don't have the ability. Everyone is given a box with something in it, and everyone describes it as a beetle and the various attributes of it. And without being able to look at each other's box, the furthest we can go is saying we each have a noun. And in semantic breakdown, a character kind of does this very highbrow teardown of something to actually destroy it. This could be an embodiment of stupefying someone with mind 2 or destroying an idea with mind 5. It can also be used to destroy something physically with matter 3 or life three, especially if you consider the realm of idea and the realm of form that we are in to be tightly connected.
We mentioned earlier that the Umbra is rife with opportunity for surrealism in the beings that live there. And so a character could perform surreal acts to please the spirits they have agreement with, gaining spirit boons. By enacting these dreamlike acts, they can gain almost arbitrary defects depending on the spirits they're working with.
Yeah, one of the things that's mentioned throughout Mage is the idea that the dream speakers are often viewed as being crazy, put that in quotes, because they are often observing a certain number of requirements that spirits have placed upon them, which forces them to act strangely, or they choose to act strangely to maintain that relationship. And if you're going to lean into spirits as being more surreal than other entities, it would make sense that characters enmeshed in that world would act similarly. Maybe an offering a character gives is every day their first impression that they have of the world is eaten by their patron spirit, and they are forced to write it down. And that is something that a character can do in world. It doesn't take a lot of time, but it, to me, adds to the theme and mood of a game.
Are there any drawbacks or advantages to making magic surreal, generally?
Heck yeah! Surreal magic is often a trade-off between flexibility and power and being quite vulgar. A character who forms tobacco smoke into a ring that grants immunity to fire may be able to perform this anywhere, but a few sleepers are going to look at it and be like, No, that tracks. So it is a potent and flexible paradigm, and it is also something where you will likely be viewed as a liability by other mages. This is a type of magic that does not have a strong tie to a lot of established magic societies. Like, a hermetic isn't necessarily going to look at it and be like, I know exactly what that person's doing. The surrealist mage will likely be a little bit weird to everyone. While this is a magic that does have precursors in a fair number of other magical traditions, it brings them together in a way that seems weird and alien, which is part of the point.
So is there any advice that you would give to people who want to bring surrealism into their games of Mage?
For me, it's starting small. Mage should be at times fantastic and eerie. The flip side of a jetpack powered by the joy of children reading comic books is that when the dread elemental arrives to infect the characters with visions of a being made out of bodies of rotting wood, whose loose, spindly, giraffe-like legs hold up four-headed bodies, each muttering the sound of children at various ages who are about to cry, that can be kind of menacing. My recommendation is make sure people know about it ahead of time. One of those things where it's like, we're going to introduce weird. And some people like horror because they know what happens, and in other people, they find that just introduces a state of dread. I am very uncomfortable watching a horror movie if I don't know what the type of horror is ahead of time. I am fine if it's a psycho killer. I am fine if it's ghosts. But if I get part of the way through and I don't know which one it is yet, I think the technical term is I freak the heck out.
Interesting.
Likewise, in Mage, this is something where I would recommend you start out slow. The other part is it is very easy to introduce surrealism and to accidentally turn it into red herrings, where you mention this odd environmental element. And I will just say, hey, this is something that your character thinks is no big deal, but every time they open the refrigerator, it makes the sound of a small angelic chant that no one else can hear. The character has the opportunity to share that with the other players, but the idea is to showcase that there is something weird and other, but also not to let the characters fixate on it or the players fixate on it if they're not supposed to. I also recommend establishing who controls the surrealism. This is something where it can be strictly the domain of the storyteller. Surrealist elements may only occur when a spell fails. A character failing to properly astral project may wake up with strange nightmares, or a surrealist element may only occur in certain places. Near nodes, the vision of a mage is clouded, and the warehouse ceiling drips with dodecahedral drops that, whenever they strike the ground, release the smell of a fake banana. That is a case where the surreal can be expected and it can be included without much difficulty. Chaz, when you think of surrealism, are there a class of, like, emotions that you think it can best inspire?
Well, for sure, weirdness is at the top of the list. the smoke butterflies whose wings are issues of National Geographic in Dutch that merge when the character's effect fails have no consequence, but certainly add weirdness.
Yeah. Again, for me, terror. The surreal can be a sign of reality melting. If a room slowly turns to clouds, is the side of the Sword of Reason's arrival, this large umbrood that is chasing after it, to cleave the infection from the dreamlike from reality. Any change that happens to the environment can be terrifying. And this is something that pops up repeatedly in Mage fiction, but we never get systems for, where it makes comments. One of my favorite lines in Orphan Survival Guide was, the room was suffused with a feeling of chocolate and a slight taste of electricity, which was my sure sign of magic being about. And that is something that I wish were more baked into the game, because I think that is fantastic and makes the game both weird and personal and very magey to me.
Surreal elements can also be a sign of madness. If only one of the players can see and respond to the surreal, or only a subset of them can see and respond, they will look quite insane to onlookers. A mage explaining how the Waxman's agents are coming to claim his glass shadow can be true and also confusing.
And don't hesitate to ramp them back. If you want something to be a kind of creeping sense of unease and the players are just playing it for jokes, remove that. This kind of goes on to the much bigger and much more difficult topic of how do we express differences in experiencing the world in Mage. For background, I went through a period of time where I was dealing with a pretty persistent infection that caused visual and auditory hallucinations. And that very much changed my experience of the expression of madness in media. And one day I will do an episode on how I approach Marauders based on that. It's very hard to tell players, you're not treating this seriously. It's much easier to just say, okay, this is not the response I want. Ramp it down, or to explain what you're going for ahead of time. Sure, we can hold ourselves up to the master storytellers that are able to effortlessly do that. I'm not one of them. So I do not feel bad just saying, hey, this is the emotion I'm going for.
It's a whole lot easier to be a master storyteller if you can emulate the effects that you want to create as a master storyteller and just tell your players what you're trying to get across.
Mm-hmm. it's one of those things where hopefully everyone at the table wants you to succeed. And speaking of which, another one that you can have is humor and frivolity. The juxtaposition of the crazy and the mundane can often be quite funny. And that is something that you should have recourse to if you want that to be in your game. The final one that I think is a little bit messy is the idea of frustration. The surreal doesn't obey paradigmatic laws in the way that we are used to, and Mage is kind of a game about willpower, whereas the surreal often requires the character to in some way surrender. The characters may need to experiment to figure out the weaknesses of the Cicerone wanderers. These are giant entities that are holding up their great iron and granite walking cannons that spit fire but hold candelabras topped with dollhouses. That one I stole directly from a Rene Magritte painting, so no originality on that one. They can only be harmed by shouting corrections to facts commonly thought true but that aren't, which I think for most mage players would actually make them trivial to defeat.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
I have all kinds of things that have jumped to mind.
Yeah, it is tricky to introduce an element to the world that is not intended to be understood. The deliberate vagueness that the surreal often encounters is often at odds with the metaphysical investigation that Mage strives for, and it may be hard to say to convince a player that they just need to come to terms with the logic of the surreal. And you can do that by stating that, where you say, after several hours, your character kind of grasped the surreal logic of the place. And you may have the character state it, a character stuck in a paradox realm where they're a short order cook being asked to prepare monkey hair. They will just describe their favorite dish of that or what have you, and the scene is complete. The goal is to get the character or the player to make a logical leap and to just lean into it and hopefully have a way to take that with them.
What can you do to get players to help establish the realism in the game?
There are a genre of things called surrealist games. These were activities that were done by the surrealists, and now you can buy them in a book for $12 on Amazon, which is its own type of surreal, to try and get into the right headspace. One is the idea of an exquisite corpse, where everyone in the group helps describe the creature, but not knowing what anyone else has done. Normally, you would do a portrait of some strange entity where Chaz would draw the head down to the shoulders, I would do the midsection, and someone else in our group would do the torso, and you would just only expose the portion that each person was going to write. If you Google exquisite corpse, you can see a lot of examples of these. You can also generate a scene or tableau with free association. The players each say an object at the same time, and you write them all down, and then you do that again with adjectives, and you pick a few and you create an elemental out of it. A thing to remember, though, with a lot of these things is, and this is the problem I probably run into the most, is mages are very squishy. You need to have some sort of assurance to the players that they can deal with the strangeness. One of the ideas of invoking the surreal and the dreamlike is a sense of terror, foreboding, and danger. But if the surreal is able to kill you, the characters are never going to want to interface with it again, or will go through Tomb of Horrors, throwing sticks through doors, trying to figure out what elements of reality are booby-trapped against them. Never surprise your players with aggravated damage. And to me, loaded questions like, is this the point where you begin to flee, is perfectly acceptable as a line that you can include.
Again, that's where we get into, it's a whole lot easier to emulate being a great storyteller by telling your players what you're trying to do.
For me, my two rules or my two guidelines are, when dealing with surreal entities, have irrational goals, but rational methods. A character that wants to romance the moon by convincing the world to never use the letter B again is a character that's hard to work with in terms of generating action. Like, that is hard to have that discourse with, in my opinion. Whereas a character who wants to romance the moon by composing the greatest planetary ballad and make it visible from Earth has a set of likely actions that that character is going to take that the players can interface with in a meaningful and interesting way that they can investigate. They help them come up with a poem, they help them do the ultimate arrangement, they come up with the etherscope that is going to allow the moon to see this. I have found the irrational goals but rational methods to work better than irrational methods with rational goals. To me, the latter just feels like madness, where the former is surreal.
That makes a lot of sense.
And with that, we've talked about mage a lot.
Let's dial the surrealism up to 11 and talk about Invisible Sun.
The reason I am partially having Chaz on, in addition to Chaz being a good co-host, having great mic hygiene, as well as being competent in the worlds of games, is that Chaz and I are in a game of Invisible Sun. Chaz, what is Invisible Sun?
Invisible Sun is a giant black box that acts as a conversation piece on your table. It includes a six-fingered hand, lots of tokens, several books, and a menu.
What do you play in Invisible Sun?
In Invisible Sun, you play a Vizsla, which is to say a wizard or mage or magic user that has recently returned to being a wizard after hiding in shadow to escape the war, which we shan't talk about.
The game is billed as surrealist, which not a huge number of RPGs are. Is there anything in the game that says to you surrealism, or one that comes to mind?
Well, other than the art that the book is full of, which definitely falls into the surreal genre of art, there are a number of game elements. For example, flux. Whenever you use magic, you roll magic dice, and when those show a zero, something weird happens. At one point, a secret of yours may pop into someone's head nearby, or books nearby could flutter about like butterflies for several minutes. At 2 points, your hair might turn permanently white, or the nearby ground could erupt in flames. And at 3 points, all kinds of wild stuff could happen. Everyone you know forgets you. You might die, which is unsurmountable in Invisible Sun. And also realize that there's only a 1 in 1,000 chance of this happening, and only when you're using the most powerful of magics.
Flux, to me, I like because it can occur on successes, that much like you can have bestial successes in V5, Flux only cares about what happens with those that set of magic dice. So you can still succeed overall and involve Flux. There's also a mechanism in the game. I think I have Sortilege down there later. One of the things I like is every character has a quirk. That is just an odd thing about them. And this is actually part of Monty Cook's advice in Your Best Game Ever, that all characters should have some sort of memorable personality trait. But in Invisible Sun, it is almost a mechanic. It is something you choose during character creation. Everyone who sees me thinks I look about like someone they know, but they can't remember who. Radios might get staticky around you. Clothing I wear slowly changes color to purple if I wear it more than four times. I might be allergic to a particular time of the day. So every day at 3:47, I sneeze. For Mage, this to me makes great small paradox backlashes that someone could pick up theoretically with perception plus alertness, but would likely be immediately knowable by other mages. It would be kind of a secret handshake almost, that we all have these weird attributes about each other. Invisible Sun literally gives you a full page front and back of these. So if nothing else, grab that. If you ever play a game of Invisible Sun with me, I was about to say, if you're ever over my house, I'm like, that's a weird thing to say on a podcast.
I used to have the quirk of everybody saying that I knew like someone they looked like. I appear to have shaken that.
The game also contains a lot of very strange beings. The book Teratology is just a book of umbral entities that has been slightly mislabeled, in the same way that I think that the overworld and underworlds of Sion are hidden mage expansions that were mislabeled. That is there. I will include some of my favorite examples in the Discord when this episode goes out, because this is not a good medium for that. I am a big fan, for instance, of the time weasels that have the ability...
Really? Weasels? What a surprise.
I realize I'm now being typecast. I'm like, oh, he likes wizards and weasels. Ah, oh, that Terry. Which are creatures that have the ability to shift themselves forward and backward through time. They have highly chromatic fur and crystalline claws, and that they use that to get the jump on prey. Another one of the neat angles are these strange dogs that have the ability to always watch you, but can only do so from a dark corner, and they have the ability to teleport between them. So it is not uncommon that in highly secretive places in Satyrene will all be in perfectly ovular or perfectly round areas to prevent these spy dogs from being able to manifest. And I think one of the weirdest things about them is they just stare at you. A little on the menacing side.
That sounds uncomfortable. Yeah.
It's called Invisible Sun. What role does the sun play in the game?
Well, there are nine suns, and the players travel between them. The players start in Satyrene, which is the second largest city in the actuality that encompasses all of existence in Invisible Sun, which is in Indigo, the sun of truth. And Satyrene is the city of notions, where the economy is driven by feelings and ideas and thoughts. They can then travel to the other suns on sunships or using magic to places like silver, which represents beginnings, red, which represents destruction, blue, which is illusions and thoughts. The gray sun, which we mentioned earlier as shadow, is an illusion devoid of magic and is the real world that we live in. Each sun is guarded by a warden that tests your mettle before visiting.
And it's interesting that Chaz said gray is the real world. One of the fundamental differences between Mage and Invisible Sun is Invisible Sun starts with the premise that the reality that we are in is the fake one, where Mage starts with the premise that the opposite. The Umbra is kind of this emanation or illusion cast by our world, and it is just a way to fundamentally investigate kind of the human phenomenon. That differs for some of the realms and so on, but that's kind of a rough way of looking at it. Can you replace the Umbra with the actuality? You could, but I think the way I would do it is I would go about replacing the Shade and Shard realms. The Shade realms would be the penumbra-like reflections that would be manifest through the spheres. So the Shade realm of creation would be a penumbra where beginning and inception of all things were visible. You could see the plan for a building and the bricks that were used to make it by stepping into that silver penumbra and using that as the lens to go back through. By going on to the Shard realm of creation, you would be more or less in what Invisible Sun would describe as silver. Silver is a great landscape where all things are born. It is where angels come from. Angels and demons in Invisible Sun have a slightly different role. Angels are considered to be the guardian and protector of what is called the legacy, the artifacts that are purported to be left behind by the creator of the universe, this massive spell that was woven that is still unfurling. The best book to look at for that is probably the Enchiridion of the Path. I love the word Enchiridion, so of course I got it.
that book is also surreal in that you can tear the pages out of it by design.
Yeah, yes, it is. It is all tear off pages. And the Invisible Sun Discord periodically has people had in the before times had mentions of people doing that and their players all going, I think it was just a stunt done by Monty so that everyone got compelled to buy two copies of it, in which case, well played, Mr. Cook. Or whoever part of the design team came up with that. If you are interested in exploring the areas beneath the other suns in some detail, my recommendation for that is the podcast Incantations, an Invisible Sun podcast. It was a limited run that just kind of explored all of the elements of the game and went through it in a certain degree of detail. The city of Saturnine is kind of interesting in that it is portrayed as being after some great war that no one talks about for fear of giving the combatants in that war too much information. It is full of surreal places. For instance, one of the main towers within the legal district of it, the first floors of it are invisible. So it appears to be floating, but it is something that you can just kind of bump into. One of the regions of it is literally tied to the bottom of the city by a great network of chains and ropes and spider silk and all sorts of things, and is creatively known as the Undersling.
There's a neighborhood called the Palindrome, where the streets and buildings are repeated on the way in and out, so that the whole layout of the neighborhood forms a palindrome on the map.
Mm-hmm. And as you walk down certain streets, each brick that you step on may say ow as you step on them, and occasionally you encounter a somewhat menacing brick that goes ooh. There will be a street where all of the trees are just great maple leaves that change color to track the emotion of those walking by. The surreal often requires a continuous process of generation, and the game tries to give you a lot of those. Monty and Shauna were probably able to produce 400 or 500 of those in probably 20 minutes, because at the end of the day, they're better writers than all of us combined. So you kind of have the surrealism of the setting, but in addition to that, it tries to create the sense of wonder, terror, and exploration of the surreal with a bunch of game mechanics that I think kind of help reinforce that, as well as some mechanics that I think are great to steal from Age. Chaz, were there any mechanics in Invisible Sun that you're like, this is a neat one?
Well, I really like the way that they do experience in Invisible Sun. I am critical of experience and advancement systems. It's one of the things that can put me off to a game if I don't like it, or that I'll really just grumble about. But Invisible Sun solves one of the core problems by splitting experience into two types. You have acumen, which lets you buy spells, secrets, skills, and that tracks what you've done in the world. Achieving the goals that you set for yourself helps you gain acumen. On the other side, you have joy and despair, which are combined to crux, and this lets you advance your core magic. So whether this is your forte, which is like your unique set of magical abilities, or your advancement within your order, crux is what lets you do that, and it kind of tracks what happens to you versus what you have done. I like this because it encourages a balance between developing along your path of power, using crux, but also just expanding the stuff that you can do with your skills and spells. This, I think, is especially relevant in a World of Darkness or storyteller system in general, because you often have a power trait that is really expensive to increase that tracks your overall power level, but then you are saving experience to invest in that in a way that takes away from your ability to like expand in other ways. So splitting those two apart really helps. And I think it would be very easy to introduce something like this into a game like Mage, where you can expand your Arete using one type of experience and all of your other stuff using regular experience or something like that.
And what causes joy and despair? It's pretty well baked into the name. Whenever something terrible happens to you, or whenever something amazing happens to you, you can get a joy or a despair. You combine those two to create a crux, and then you spend that on something. This also is, to me, diegetically useful, because it could help explain why characters who spent all their time studying magic aren't actually better at magic. You could say that you could acquire spheres using acumen. You sit your ass down and you study. but you need this other type of XP to advance your retail. Only by living do you get the raw material that allows you to expand your understanding of the world and truly become more potent as a mage. This also introduces a separate mechanic known as the GM shift or the GM intrusion, if you're a Numenera fan, which basically says the GM is only allowed to go, no, 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 that didn't happen. More or less in exchange for them giving you something. So here's an example. If the characters are absolutely housing something, a storyteller could say, well, I'm going to knock two successes off of that roll. I'm going to give you a despair for it. And then this happens. And then on the flip side, something where the characters are absolutely getting kicked in the face and a character is about to die or something like that, the GM kind of says the person's gun jams or what have you, you get a sense of relief and you get a joy from this, from the GM kind of changing the game. At first, I thought this was kind of cheating, but it is something that has happened in games for a while anyway. And it also is useful in a game where one of the problems that we mentioned with the surreal is that wacky stuff that can seemingly kill your character or make a encounter absolutely trivial can occur. By allowing these GM shifts, you put bumpers on that, and also you reward the player with something.
Is there anything in particular that you like out of Invisible Sun that you think could be brought to Mage in some way?
Out of that big box, which is in no way pretentious, Monica, there is a deck of cards that is included called the Soothe Deck.
They're round.
Yes, they're circular cards. And on each of them, it has a neat piece of art, a title, as well as two other stats. And as a play aid, each scene, a new card is turned, which can be used to help guide the scene. And I am uncomfortable with the number of times that the players have sat down to play a game of Invisible Sun, and I had a plot that was going along smoothly until a Soothe Deck card came up, and I'm like, oh, that is a cat made out of mice eating a tree. That's a way better scene idea than what I had planned, and then I just kind of run with that. It's kind of like a tarot deck, but for Invisible Sun, and it is diegetic. Characters within the game will use the Soothe Deck. The GM book includes a large section on how to interpret it. I like it because if you're not familiar with the tarot, it does a good job of telling you what's on the tin. Like, the Seven of Wands isn't obvious as much to me as saying the card called the Revealing Knife, which shows a large knife cutting a building in half to show what is inside. It also informs something called the Currents of Magic. The idea is, in Invisible Sun, magic is alive and active as a mode of force. And as you play cards, each one of these Soothe Deck cards will be able to modify how easily you can do magic, either more or less difficult by usually zero, sometimes one, or rarely two. This is roughly analog to changes in difficulty within Mage, as well as affecting more or less your essence. So you will reveal a card, and I would say everyone with primordial essence is at +1 for this round. Everything they do, they get an additional die, or is it -1 difficulty? There is a Storyteller Vault supplement called, I think, Faces of Magic, that Secrets of the Masquerade did, that outlines a similar system, and it is yet another way in which the characters can be stymied out of nowhere or become super potent for a round and not even realize why.
One system that I've been interacting with a lot in the course of our game is depletion. Magic items in Invisible Sun often come with a depletion where on use you roll a die, and depending on how powerful the depletion is, your result can tell you that the item loses its magic. These things are finite. This is great because game comes with like hundreds of items that are single use or have depletion on them. And so it encourages you to use your thing so that you can also get something new. There's some limits to how many magic items that you have. And then I was saying, as a maker, this is one of the knobs that I can adjust. So if I'm crafting an item, one of the easiest ways for me to control how much I have to invest in it is to pick the depletion level. And generally, I'm adverse to using up my resources in games, but since Invisible Sun hands out rewards so often, and you can only have like 3, it really encourages you to use stuff so you can get something else.
Yeah, like normally, for instance, I, as a storyteller, don't have any hesitancy giving the group access to a powerful magical item if it's listed as depletion 0 through 4, which means literally half the time that they use the item, it will never work again. So I know that they will get at least one usage out of it. They may get a few more, but if it turns out what I give them is wildly unbalanced, it's only going to stick around for a certain period of time. Invisible Sun wants you to be a kid in a candy store, but you can only go to that candy store once a day for 45 minutes.
Definitely.
This is also how they handle effects. Rather than you determining how long an effect works ahead of time, the effect rolls for depletion. And I think this is something we could also take back in World of Darkness. For instance, your stupefy spell, or the thing that you do to convince someone to let you in, will work, but the effect will wear out each turn. You roll 10 minus their willpower, and on a roll of that or above, the effect breaks, and that is another way to bring it in. It is an attempt to reduce the amount of bookkeeping, and the game is very explicit that if you forget to roll for depletion, it just breaks. The game is very explicit on the storyteller has to do a lot in this game. Darn it, player, if you can't keep track of one thing, it fails. And that is also a recurring theme in Monte Cook games, along with there being large cities with a number of warring factions in them.
Another really nice thing in Invisible Sun from a mechanical perspective is that things have a universal level. So when you're creating an antagonist or an ally or an effect as a GM, you just give it a level. And that kind of describes everything about it. You can give it modifiers, like if this thing is really good at jumping, it gets a bonus when its level matters for jumping. And there is a creature like that in the Book of Creatures. But it makes GM prep a lot easier when you can boil things down to a level. Story path games have kind of suggested how you could do this for storyteller games, saying that everything has a strong, moderate, and weak action pool as their primary traits, and then they get a couple of special abilities. Terry, do you think that's something that could be adapted to Mage?
I wish. This is probably... There is this giant chart that comes with the game that says magical abilities of this type are always going to be this level. For instance, a level one ability is going to be the ability to cause subtle changes to the weather in a nearby area. So within a couple of feet, you can make it slightly windier, slightly colder, slightly hotter, slightly brighter, slightly darker. And then at level four, that is the ability at which you get to levitate. Five is where you get to fly. So whenever you have a question of, can I do this? The game says, this is the maximum level of what you can do. You look at the chart, and ultimately, as a game master, I have that ability to determine, can you do it or not? Chaz's character is a maker. Ardesia can make arbitrary things. And the question is, well, what can I do? Well, you can make things up to level five. And this is what level five things are. And it just clarifies everything. It is obscene. I have not figured out a way to do it. And it is that thing that, like, at the end of the day, when I have 5 minutes, I just stare at that chart and go, like, how do I mage you? The eight, no, nine suns. I'm like, piece of cake, but this one stupid chart I haven't quite figured out. The closest I've been able to do is that story path method where you say small, medium, and large pools and then figure out approximately what they are. As regards systems that I like, Swordilege is a big one. A character may just do a magic flex to add a die to anything they do. This is a game where you use pools, where instead of having attribute plus ability, you have a number of pools that you spend points from as you're doing things. You can spend a point of Swordilege to let you roll a magic die when doing something. To me, if I were to introduce this in Mage, the way I would do this is it would be kind of a magical flex that I would spend a point of quintessence or a point of willpower, and I could roll two sets of dice for a mundane task and take the preferred one. Although I would have the possibility of accruing paradox with that second set of dice. I'm thinking of a slight refinement to it where you would map spheres to attributes. Like, say you mapped forces to strength, you would be able to spend a point of quintessence to roll twice, and in your strength plus athletics roll to throw something, for instance. On that second one, you would use forces plus athletics, which could be more, which could be less. I like it because it allows masters to do weird flexes at the cost of paradox on mundane actions, and that is probably how I would draw that Swordilege system in.
Another one that has a familiar analog in Mage are secrets. We mentioned them earlier. Secrets kind of give your character a bunch of unique abilities or benefits. Essentially, they're like merits, but there's a whole lot of them, and they are baked into the system as at their core. And unlike merits, they can be earned. For example, a character who wants a secret thalassic mastery that grants better control over the water may pay 4 experience points or acumen and need to spend some time tutelage of someone who already has it. From my perspective, merits in World of Darkness always felt like an incomplete system, being tacked on rather than baked in. Chronicles of Darkness does it better, since it's built into the core assumptions of the system, and they're better balanced, especially because they're not accompanied by flaws, which are way harder to cost appropriately without putting a major burden on the GM. And so secrets in their form in Invisible Sun are similar, where they're built into the core assumption of the system that characters are going to have access to these minor abilities that can let them use their magic in new and unique ways.
And some of the secrets, they represent kind of glitches in reality, as it were. They almost remind me of the powers in Demon the Descent, where there is some occult physics that you've gained access to. And some of them can be simple things like, I get one additional die whenever I am doing a forces effect that involves fire. Pretty simple, 5-10 experience points or what have you. And the game is pretty generous with handing this out. Or it can be something like, I know how to talk to insects. And for 2 experience points, it is non-magical. Also, I always get a +2 die bonus on any of my interaction with sentient insects. And it also includes a lot of metamagical things. Like, for instance, for 5 experience points, I can spend 1 point of quintessence to double the number of targets that an effect has, or to increase the range of something that is normally limited in range. As Chaz said, there's a bunch of them. And a lot of them are, at least to me, quite flavorful and kind of interesting in that regard. And they give recommendations on, hey, characters that have this secret have this identifying feature to them. For instance, there is a attribute of, the first one is green thumb, which is a bit of a joke, but you can get it for any of the colors of the suns. You can become an indigo thumbed character, where one of your thumbs is that color, and magic of that type always costs you 1 less to do, or you get 1 additional die when rolling for it. And that is interesting, and it's very obvious that as a storyteller, I can be like, blah, blah, you meet this character who has a red thumb. And anyone in the know is going to get a little bit of information about that.
Not only do you define your character, but you also define where you live, and that can be weird and surreal. For example, Ardesia, my character, lives in a giant tree, and in the basement, her workshop is surrounded by the roots of the tree, and in the top of the tree, there is a ladder to a strange place that has a yellow sun, where I grow a garden in this little pocket reality, and I live with a stork. And like, all of those things are things that are built into my character's house, which is part of what you define when you're making your character and placing it in a neighborhood in Saturain.
Invisible Sun is a game where they finally lean into the fact that a lot of wizards are likely introverts. The game kind of assumes the default is downtime, and then you take periodic breaks from that to quote-unquote adventure. And your house can have secrets, too. As Chaz advances, Chaz would spend some acumen, and the house manifests a hidden room that is only available to her, or another area she could designate that one of her rooms, people can only say nice things about her in that room, or they can be strictly atmospheric things. For instance, dishes that automatically put themselves away and clean themselves after each use. It would kind of be like if Mage had a much more flexed out, I would not say chantry system, but at least a more fleshed out sanctum system. And it gives you a whole bunch of recommendations on that. One of my favorite ones is, I think at level 8, there's level 8 or 10 level secret where your house is a person that can follow you around. And if you ask the person nicely, they will turn back into your house. If the person dies for any reason, your house returns to Saturain. The game's real big on not dicking over players, which I'm like, thanks, Monty! In terms of like other mechanics that other games have that Invisible Sun also has that I wish Mage had, is the connections trait, which is a background that represents a person or organization that can come to your assistance. This can be used in 2 ways. One, it can be a bonus to roles. It can be just a social influence thing when dealing with that group. Also, it can kind of act as a required minimum level. So in Mage, for instance, one character that is a technocrat could not advance without 3 dots of backing, requiring the character to do something to get in the good grapes of the group. It's one of those things where if Ardesia wants a particular book, I would say, well, you need 2 dots in a connection to the Vancian Library before you can do that. And that can involve a side scene or a side quest, or it could just involve spending acumen to get what is needed there. Both are acceptable.
Another kind of neat rule that Invisible Sun has is hidden knowledge. All characters have this pool of hidden knowledge, which is just the accumulated facts that you know, and you can spend that at any point to reduce the difficulty of a role. It's handed out anytime you spend a lot of time exploring, socializing, or doing research or reading. It's one of the things that you can say you're working on during downtime. It can also be a consolation if you don't find the actual thing you're looking for, if you're searching a library or spending time somewhere strange. I think you could probably pull that into Mage kind of as is. And it's kind of fun because you just get to justify a reason that your character knows how something works based on the fact that they are a well-studied individual.
And the two don't need to tie. One person's character could spend months in an arcane library, but in a social situation, they could say, well, my character picked up this piece of gossip. They are functionally equivalent. You don't need to, how you got it and how you spend it don't need to be tied. But at the time of spending, you need to say, hey, this is where I got this little bit of information. We all know that the true bane of any storytelling group is getting everyone together. And the way the game treats this is with the idea that periodically your character forgets that they are a Vizslay and returns to shadow. If a player can't make it, their character is simply listed as having gone away. Likewise, in Mage, if a player couldn't make it, we could say that they simply fell into quiet. For some mages, this could mean teleporting back to a mundane life until they are faced with a reminder to reawaken. But it's very much just a way to justify, well, only three of us are free tonight. We're going to have the story go forward, and we're not going to deal with the BS of justifying what happened to Sally's character. One of the ideas in Mage, though, is that once you awaken, you can't unawaken. But I think it's not unreasonable to say that there is a type of quiet where you forget that you're a mage temporarily. And if a group wanted to do that and a character were temporarily transported to a paradox realm or what have you, I think that's a perfectly fine justification if it allows you to play more mage. So we have talked a lot about Invisible Sun as a setting, but we haven't really talked about how the surrealism manifests. I feel like we talked more about those in the Mage section. In the game we have played so far, was there anything so far that you've been like, that's some surreal bullshit?
Oh, yeah. All the time. Well, I guess for one thing, I mentioned that the Stork who lives in my character's house, who also manages my portfolio on the Notions Exchange, and that's some surreal nonsense if ever there was. As a maker, I have to come up with little narrative justifications for the things that I'm making. And I was very pleased with the first item that I made, which was essentially a simple holographic camera that could take a three-dimensional picture. But I looked at the ingredients that I had, and one of the level one ingredients is honey. I was like, I'm going to make this holographic camera out of honey. And the reason being is that honey is made from nectar, from colorful flowers, and I am reconstituting the colors out of the honey in order to infuse them into the glass to make this camera. So I think you can think about surreal ideas for logical conclusions in Invisible Sun. So you talked about in storytelling, you want to have surreal objectives with logical means. I think in Invisible Sun, you can almost do the opposite, especially in the hands of a player. Have a logical objective and achieve it with surreal means because of the surrealism baked into the setting. It is expected that things are going to work in weird ways, that ideas are more important than realities. We also had the mole people who talk like Werner Herzog in the local bar where our characters get together, and they like come in and recite poetry. And like just all of these elements kind of add to the surrealism. We mentioned the art at the top, and just like flipping through an Invisible Sun book, you're going to see a whole bunch of surreal imagery. And it follows what Terry mentioned, that technically it's very good and like has a realistic look to the style of the art, even though the thing being depicted is always weird.
A few of the ones I like are, this has not been encountered, but the god in the wine glass, which is a god that is essentially bound to a glass of wine that is sitting on a table in an empty house, that if the glass is ever knocked over, they're going to make reality burn. and systematically in the game, this is represented as being a level 15 entity. The power scale in Invisible Sun is kind of exponential, where each increase is a bigger step than the one before it. So the gap between 1 and 2 is significantly smaller than between 10 and 11 in terms of ultimate power. There is an entity called the Unforgiving Clock, which is this kind of golem clockwork monstrosity that reminds people of the importance of time. There is Naomela, the Eternal Student, who is a character that each day forgets who they are, but remembers all of the magic that they have ever learned, and knows every spell that a Vancian can learn, which is a particular type of creature. There is a character that fought in the war that, in an attempt to become more and more defensive, has literally turned their body into a series of floating castles, kind of to represent their attempt to insulate themselves from the emotional damage that they have experienced. So they are physically transforming themselves to try and deal with the emotional damage that they have suffered, and needless to say, it never works. The Veiled Child is just a Victorian schoolchild wearing a hood that, when you pull it back, their face is a very large moth. So this is one of those cases where when you fill out one of those forms at the beginning of a game that says, what are the things that make you uncomfortable with? You might want to be more detailed than you are normally in terms of tableaus and images that you find viscerally upsetting. And then there's Jaden, who is the creature from Shadow, who is just a barista that is one of the most dangerous creatures because they are from Shadow but somehow able to walk about Saturnine. So I like that Starbucks is one of the most pernicious entities that exists in all of the actuality.
We've talked about Mage and Invisible Sun. Are there other games that incorporate surrealism to you?
Yes, and I did not realize that I had a type until I'm like, oh, what other surrealist RPGs are there? Let me see if I have any of them. The answer is no, I don't have any of them. I have all of them. And the ones that come to mind, if you're very interested in talking about the surrealist movement, Dreamhounds of Paris is a Pelgrane Press game where you are characters that literally have the ability to explore the dreamlands, which is this great of place of great power that artists have the ability to kind of walk in and modify. And I think Dashiroko is listed as the first artist in modern times to be able to access it, and there's kind of this war over it. Over the Edge is a game that is now put out, I believe, by Atlas Games that slowly reveals that the setting is not quite nonsensical, but close and kind of out there. Are you familiar with Over the Edge? Have you played it all? Or
I am. I have played Over the Edge. The characters that we were playing with were Santa Claus on vacation. I was secretly an elephant. There was a Starfleet officer, and I forget what the other two characters were, but we were stuck in a bar where Mr. T was the bartender, and the devil was selling secrets in a corner as the Meow Mix jingle played. It was wild.
Yeah. Lacuna is a kind of OSR-ish game that has a lot of surreal elements to it. It is in a strange city that I have difficulty describing it. It is a modern, gritty, urban surreal, for lack of a better term. It is surreal in a menacing way, in the ways that like the SCP or the video game Control are kind of surreal. There is just these large unexplained aspects of the world around you. There, you're in a strange town that seems to be observing odd laws. One of the PDF Kickstarter supplements they had just describes kind of an apartment building in one part of it. I'm like, I could replace the entirety of the Umbra with this one very well-described apartment building with strange rules to it. Itris Bai is a surreal setting that has a lot of dreamlike setting pieces to it, and also uses a random deck to determine outcome. Are there any World of Darkness or Chronicle of Darkness games that you feel are surreal?
I think both Changeling games can have elements that fall into this category. Changeling the Dreaming has the dreamlike qualities of chimerical reality that your characters see layered on top of the regular world, and the opportunity to get weirder, as we mentioned, when you travel into the dreaming, which is defined by ideas. Changeling the Lost has systems for literally traveling into dreams. So if one of the defining qualities of surrealism is dreamlike, well, you're in dreams, so it's a great place to have some surrealism happening. You can also travel into the Hedge, which is the barrier between our world and the alien realm of the Fae, and it is also full of Fae weirdness and hobgoblins who follow their own weird logics and is supposed to be kind of menacing and alien. So if you want to kind of dial up the weirdness and terror aspect of the surreal, that's a good place to do it.
We should talk about changing the law sometime. That seems
I think territory. We might.
Yeah.
Watch this space.
Yeah. In other media, two surrealist books that I've encountered recently are The Last Days of New Paris, which kind of follows that Dreamlands-like thing where people find a way to unleash the power of the surreal and wages a war using these surreal entities to do so, as well as Nick Harkaway's The Gone Away World, where there's this weapon that is created that destroys the stuff, but not the information contained within an idea. And if that information then floats into or by someone who is conscious, they have the ability to manifest whatever they are thinking about. And needless to say, that goes poorly. And I will include links to those as well in the show notes. Chaz, any closing thoughts on surrealism or Invisible Sun before we call it to a close?
I'm looking forward to playing more Invisible Sun and exploring whatever weirdness you have prepared for us.
Yeah. As I'm fond of saying, Invisible Sun is escapism for my escapism. So it's a heck of a barrier to entry, but if you know a friend that was compelled enough to buy it, try and sit down and have a play, and if nothing else, thumb through the books to see the art. And you can just Google Invisible Sun art or Invisible Sun or look up Invisible Sun on Pinterest, and you will get a lot of good things that I think are at least inspirational for things like what an avatar looks like, what a hobgoblin looks like, what the high umbra in certain areas could look like. Games have advanced over time. Surrealism is an avenue that we've figured out a better way to explore. And by all means, beat up other games and rummage through their pockets for spare change if you want to bring it back to yours. Well, speaking of surrealism, when I think surrealism, I don't think of Exalted, but you run a live play for it. So Chaz, where can we find out more about what you're up to?
You can find me on Twitter as @StoryToldChaz. I am currently hosting two podcasts, kind of. One is The Systematic Understanding of Everything, where along with Terry and Monica, we explore everything Exalted, and we are nearing the conclusion of our run, which has been exciting. I am also the storyteller and producer for the Fall of Giara actual play of Exalted on the Story Told podcast feed, where we have a kinship of Dragonblooded who are dealing with the rebellion in Giara, and have come to see Giara as an adopted homeland and are now struggling to defend it. And we are also nearing the exciting conclusion of that campaign. I, of course, have many more podcast projects on the back burner. So if you want to see what else I'm doing, you can follow me on Twitter.
Thanks, Chaz. I look forward to seeing you in Saturn before I see you again, before we meet at the Catafalque. That was a terrible joke. I'll probably cut that. Chaz, thanks for joining. This has been Mage the Podcast, where if you were in shadow, we'd totally tell you. The show is made possible by our executive producers, who are Alexander Gorton, Anders S., Andrew Edelstein, Andy, Berto, Boogers, 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 Brendan Morrill, Bryce Perry, Christopher Zach, Dan Svensson, Dennis Osborne, Entropy Prime, Freddy, Gargoyle Lenoir, Guy Conan Stewart, Ian, Isabella Castillo, Jason Kennedy, Jay Sunser, Jenna F., John Horton, John Magnuson, Josh Golden, Josh H., Josh Heath, Leslie Weatherstone, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nabarro, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klemenov, Ralph Scheinhammer, Richard Bat Brewster, Ryan Hilton, Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Stephen Carton, William Connolly, and William Martin. I'd also like to thank Christopher Phillips, Oracle of High Quality Folding Chairs, and Buck Farmer, Oracle of Reliable Kitchen Timers. Our EP shout-out this time is to Stephen Carton, who is actually a level 12 demon known as Conflagration, who is a noted singer in silver who plays the pyrophone with a backing band of demons in a group called Matchbox Full of Faithful. They can eat spells of less than level 12, making them remarkably difficult to destroy in combat. Stephen is being slowly consumed until only a voice remains. In the meantime, thanks for your support! If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hop in Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality, or the actuality, as per your choosing. Bye!